And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. If you're looking for awards season frontrunners, you'll do no better than the new drama 12 Years a Slave. As the movie prepares for a wider release, we'll talk about a whole bunch of things, from the story to the script to the extraordinary cast. Then we'll offer some suggestions for rites of cultural passage, those things that might help kids through the door to the terrifying and marvelous world of adulthood. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, Stephen Thompson is taking a well-deserved staycation, and Trey Graham is taking some also sort of staycation, also equally well-deserved. So we are happy, as always, to be joined by our pals from Code Switch, Gene Demby. What do you do at NPR?
I am the lead blogger for NPR's Code Switch, and I'm Kat Chow's primary antagonist.
And speaking of Kat Chow, Kat Chow, what do you do at NPR?
I am a social media producer and blogger for Code Switch.
Well, those of you who follow the show know that we are always happy to see Gene and Kat. They have been with us on a few other occasions, and we're all together again.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, it's always wonderful news that we can all be together for the uproarious romp, 12 Years a Slave.
Oh.
So Gene was with us a few weeks ago when we talked about fiascos, and we talked about one of Gene's favorite movies, Red Tails. And at that time, we talked about the fact that that I was trying to set him up for, you know, 12 Years a Slave, while realizing that it shared a screenwriter, John Ridley, with Red Tails. So I'm going to go to Gene first. Gene Demby, what is your verdict, 12 Years a Slave?
So I'm still kind of reeling from this movie. It is a very, very hard movie. It was masterful, but it is not. It's not the kind of movie I've actually have not talked about it with anyone, because I haven't been able to talk about it with anyone, because I just feel like so many feelings. But it's a really hard movie. I'm very curious as to how it performs, like, once it is open to wide release.
Yeah, if you don't know the story, when Gene talks about the fact that it's a hard movie, this is the story of he was a free black man in New York prior to the emancipation of slaves. He was a free black man in New York, and he was kidnapped and transported to the South and sold into slavery and lived, as they say, 12 years. And it's the story of sort of his life with a few different people that he got to know while he was a slave. And for me, the ways that this movie is a better movie about slavery than we usually get are tied up with the ways that it's a good movie. Because I sat around trying to think, like, why are movies about slavery often so unsatisfying to me? And I think one of the reasons is that they're often very generic. Mm-hmm. Often the presentation of slavery is very generic. It's either very noble and suffering, or you get kind of that weird thing that Samuel L. Jackson was doing in Django, that whole deal. But you rarely get these really individual experiences. And I think one of the things that makes this movie so devastating is simply one of the things that makes it a good movie, which is that these are all individual characters. And it should not be revelatory to see a movie where slaves are recognized to be individual human beings who are having individual human experiences. Mm-hmm. But it sort of was. And that's one of the things that really struck me about the film. Kat, what did you think?
I thought it was really good and really well done. And what struck me the most was seeing the relationships between Solomon Northrup, the man who was kidnapped and made into a slave, and the slave owners, because it was almost like it wasn't so cut and dry. It kind of walked the line of almost friendly, but then there are these really messed up instances where it would get violent, and I think it played that tenuous line really well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's kind of what I mean when I say they have individual experiences.
Yeah, exactly.
That everybody who was involved, you know, all of the slaves in the film have different approaches to sort of how are you going to live, how are you going to continue to get up every day.
Survival's not about certain death. It's about keeping your head down.
Days ago, I was with my family in my home. Now you tell me all is lost. Tell no one who I am. That's the way to survive. Well, I don't want to survive. I want to live.
Yeah. When I told people I was going to see this film, I got a lot of, ooh, I don't know if I can go see that. That seems very intense. And that irked me in the way that somebody sitting down to a sumptuous meal in a restaurant says, I'm starving. You're not starving. You can go and see a movie. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The experience is the horrifying thing. This blot on the American soul is the thing. And going to see a movie is, you know, a lot less intense than that. But I think a legitimate question people are asking before they go see the film is this just homework? Is the impulse behind this film simply to educate, to instruct, to show us something we haven't seen before? Because if it is, I would argue it might be better done in a documentary. Or is there about this film, I don't want to say artistic merit, but is there something that kind of lifts it up, transports it, has it say something about the human spirit, the human soul, whatever? I think after seeing this film, there's no way you can come down as anything but this is a piece of art. And it does this really hard thing, which you mentioned, Kat. It when you're dramatizing anything and you're getting close to a subject that comes prepackaged with emotional force, like slavery, like rape, like abortion, like dead puppies, anything there where our reaction is visceral before it's intellectual.
Right.
Anytime you're doing that, your job as a writer is to get the hell out of the way and let the momentum of this giant prepackaged emotion do the work. Because the minute you start to comment, underline, or even try to direct the audience's attention anywhere, it starts to feel manipulative. So that's what I was on guard for throughout this whole thing. And I didn't come away with that. There are moments where the dialogue feels a little janky because I think most of it is lifted from Northrop's book, dropped in.
Yeah.
And in that sense, it's not that it doesn't work. It's just that it feels like it's summarizing thoughts as opposed to delivering them. But there are moments when the film shuts up, and there are two, and this will be mildly spoilery, there are two moments in this film which are completely silent in terms of dialogue, which are the most affecting. One is, you know, I always joke in heavy films like this that I like the musical number. I can't make that joke because there is a musical number here involving a spiritual, a gospel song, where nothing happens on screen except, well, the reason it happens is because the director trusts Ejiofor to do the work.
Right.
There is a very...
This is Chiwetel Ejiofor, who plays Solomon Northup.
Right. And as he's listening to this, to his fellow slaves sing this hymn, something happens to the character that's very important. It's a small change, but it's a change from the beginning of the scene to the end. And it's never commented upon. It's never underlined. It just exists. And then, you know, the director, Steve McQueen, is known in his previous films, Hunger and Shame, for being what I consider, like, skillfully showy. I guess you'd say he kind of moves the camera around, does really, really long takes. And there's a long take near the end of this film, which is just Ejiofor looking worried. And at one point, he does the thing that is the riskiest thing. He looks directly into the camera. He looks directly at us. And that moment was so intense. Because we've just seen flayed skin. The thing that made me look away from the screen was that soul-searching moment that blew me away.
The thing about the scene with the spiritual that was so powerful was that it kind of encapsulated the entire kind of trajectory of the part of the life, his life that we drop in on, right?
Like,
we start with him, and he's this well-dressed guy from New York, and he's slowly, like, being more and more dehumanized, and he's slowly having to, like, shed parts of, or at least, like, subsume or sublimate parts of himself as the story goes on. And when that scene happens with the spiritual, it felt like him turning himself over to this fate that happened upon him.
Would you say that he was exactly, like, turning himself over to that fate, or... I guess finding a way to really deal with it.
Well, I mean, it seemed, for most of the movie, it seemed like he was kind of trying to cling to his humanity in his previous life. And that was the first time it felt like he was like, okay, I'm riven with despair. And this is my life, and I'm resigned to it.
Yeah. One of the things I really thought was interesting about the story is that I don't know exactly what I expected, but I don't know that I expected a film about such a terribly sad story to have a lot of nuance to the way that it addressed these characters. And to me, the most affecting thing that really stuck with me after I saw it was that one of the really worst things, if not the worst thing, that happens to him and to a lot of the other slaves he meets as well, is their loss of the ability to be compassionate toward each other. And that becomes really a privilege and a luxury to worry about other people and whether they're okay. And I think the sort of the low point for him physically comes in a scene when he's being essentially punished for various transgressions of talking back and other things. And there's a lot of time spent on showing you that there are other slaves who are essentially going about their business. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I really think is an accomplishment of the film is that there's no sense of like, it's right there in the title, 12 Years a Slave, that eventually he is rescued, right? He is found out. And that's how he came to write the book. But there's no sense that this is some great, now everything is wonderful.
Right.
Because there's a great kind of weight to the idea that he is leaving, but everyone else is staying.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not one that spends a lot of time building up that he has, like, close buddies or, like, that he's friends with everyone, because those things are just not really available to him. But that he feels enough compassion for other people, even though he's had to, that's one of the things I think he has to sublimate the most, is that by the time you get to the end, you realize that he's really carrying the weight of all these other people, and understanding that although he's incredibly relieved to be going home, there's great pain involved.
And then another thing that really caught me was the lack of power that he had when he was first kidnapped. He kept saying, "I'm a free man," and they kept telling him, "Well, produce your papers, you don't have them."
"Well, boy, how you feel now?"
"My name is Solomon Northup. I'm a free man.
And you have no right whatsoever to detain me."
"You're no free man. You're nothing but a Georgia runaway."
The feeling that I got from watching that was like when you have a really bad dream and you're trying to scream or something like that, but you can't.
Right.
And that sense kind of just was so pervasive throughout the whole film.
Yeah.
How much do you think McQueen's Britishness or his non-Americanness contributed to that? I mean, Bilal Qureshi, our colleague here at NPR, did a piece about how this movie is, and several other movies that are coming out this fall that have black casts and kind of black principles, are made by people who are black but not African-American,
right,
and they don't have our American kind of desire for, like, absolution. So this is not a movie about race that,
right,
which everyone is redeemed at the end.
Right.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it certainly has a different sensibility. There's something different about it. It doesn't feel, even like Roots, it feels fundamentally different,
right,
than that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that always interests me is the difference between documenting events and telling a story. The actual Northrop was beaten severely many, many, many times, regularly, was whipped and beaten many, many times. It is implied in the film, but it's not shown, for a narrative reason, because if we were to see something, even something as horrible as that, over and over again, as many times as it happened, it would cease to have its impact, which is a horrifying thing to think about, but that's actually true. That's why the moments of really brutal flayings are saved for, like, so they,
right,
can have a big impact. So that dance that they have to do, I don't know if an American director would be able to make that kind of choice in the way that Steve McQueen did.
Yeah, I have tried in talking about this movie to pull back from it enough to say, yes, it's incredibly difficult to watch, and yes, it is brutal at times. But at the same time, it's a really interesting story,
right,
of this individual guy and how he moved through this experience. The smart thing about the way they tell this story and the magic of Northup as a narrator for this story is that when you tell a story about something that is as awful as slavery is, you want there to be someone who is not inured to it by the time they first experience it.
Right.
So you have that outsider perspective when he gets the sense of, like, what this is like when they first have the scene, for example, where each of the slaves has to be judged on how much cotton they picked that day.
Mm-hmm.
You have an outsider's perspective from somebody saying, this is so horrible. But usually when you get that outsider's perspective, it's because, you know, it's completely different and yet the same to say, like, it's Emma Stone in The Help. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's,
exactly.
It's
right.
The way you have an outsider's perspective on a racial issue is to use a white person. So
yes.
So that they're not, because the sense is like, well, a slave on a plantation would already be used to it by the time you meet them in the story.
Mm.
So what makes him an interesting narrator for the movie is that you manage to get an outsider's perspective, someone who's not accustomed to it and isn't prepared for it, but yet you don't have that horrible problem that I've mentioned a bunch of times about slavery movies or civil rights movies,
right,
or whatever. Lincoln, sorry,
right,
that wind up being civil rights stories or slavery stories about white people,
mm-hmm,
because you're trying to look at it from that kind of audience perspective and outside perspective.
And as the story keeps rolling, I found myself, and I could hear the audience members at the screening I went to doing the same thing. They were rooting for him to to take the less aggressive, I mean, like, it was always like, hey, be dehumanized, like, right. don't make this worse for yourself. So every time, you know, he would speak back, everyone was like, what are you doing? What are you doing?
Yeah. Right.
Because they knew.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know. When he does take some action to challenge one of the overseers, there was cheering in the audience that I saw it with.
Was it?
Because, I mean, but this film does not fire the same Quentin Tarantino parts of your brain in absolutely. Any way.
Right. No,
so that
not at
felt
all.
Like a weird reaction to me.
Yeah, when that scene happened, I think there were people like, oh no, this is going to end really badly for him. And it ended terribly for him.
Paul Dano, man. That
yeah.
guy. That guy.
Well,
so
that,
punchable.
That's the
so
thing.
Punchable.
He is maybe the most punchable person ever. That is one of the things that's interesting is that there is this great cast and there are a bunch of tremendous black actors, not only Edge of Four, but, you know, Alfre Woodard mm-hmm. and, you know, bunches of people. But when you look at the cast, you also see kind of this lineup of famous white actors,
yeah.
which is an interesting thing. You've got like Benedict Cumberbatch and
Brad Pitt.
And Brad Pitt.
Paul Giamatti.
And when I came out of this movie, I saw it in Toronto with Bob Mondello. When the lights came up, I turned to Bob and I said, one thing. I have one complaint with this movie. And I said, can you guess what it is? And Bob was sort of baffled. Yep. And I said, that Brad Pitt.
Yes.
I said this movie was doing such an amazing job not being the kind of movie mm-hmm. that would have a glowing Brad Pitt cameo.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden there's a glowing Brad Pitt cameo.
Yeah.
Like, I got to the end of the movie, it's like, well, you don't want a movie to be too perfect. You want to have your little thing where you say, well, this is my downside. Everything else is upside.
Right.
The whole time we were rolling our eyes, like, oh, come on, this dude can't be real. It turned out he was an actual person.
Yeah,
oh, he's
absolutely.
Real.
Oh, really?
He's
yeah.
real.
Wow.
But I would much rather have had, for example, the Michael Fassbender character and the Brad Pitt character switched, you know?
Yeah.
Or Brad Pitt play anyone else in the movie. Because there is
except
kind of that,
the hero type,
it's
yeah.
Brad Pitt, whoa, he's right, arrived. Sure. It's, you know, because he winds up playing a role. I don't think it's too spoilery to say. Winds up playing a role in ultimately straightening out what's happened to Solomon. And I don't know. That was my one gripe.
But at least you get to see what Brad Pitt would look like as Harrison Ford in Witness. At least you get to see that.
As Canadian Harrison
exactly.
Ford in Witness.
The other thing that was interesting about the spectrum of, like, there were all these individual kind of responses to slavery. Was it just like the range of venality among the slave owners? I mean, mm-hmm. you've got Benedict
yeah,
Cumberbatch,
totally.
Who was like, I guess, trying to be like the humane
nice
slave
guy.
Owner.
Yeah.
But he was a slave owner.
Well,
right.
Exactly.
Right?
And, then,
and he wasn't like maleficent guy that Michael Fassbender was. And still, you have Paul Giamatti, who was just like this completely cynical. Like
that yeah. scene at the beginning when they're doing the sale.
Yeah.
Is to me, that is one of the ones that I think I would have the hardest time watching again, even
yeah,
though it's not
yeah.
the most violent.
Mm-hmm.
He's so awful. And
yeah.
he's so, I mean, you are so quickly introduced to this world in which there is no humanity and
yeah,
there is
exactly.
no dignity and you are not treated in any way like a person. And it's not like you don't know that academically about slavery,
right.
but there's something about that scene in which, you know, they're trying to pick out which ones they're going to take
and how much and they'll pay.
How much they'll pay.
Yeah.
I think maybe even more than the ones that are more physically grueling, that was a particularly...
It was really hard to watch, yeah.
Yeah, that is a hard scene to watch. And it's funny because I get to the end of this conversation, I want to say to people, like, but you should totally see it. Like, it's so good. You should totally see it.
I say see it now because it's going to be one of those ones that's up for an Oscar, and you don't want to have to, like, power through. Like, this is one of those ones, not for the show, I would have saved it for the big, like, marathon.
The push
viewing.
Toward
yeah.
the end, yeah.
At the thing. And that's just not, you can't just see this now.
Yeah, I think that's very true. You don't necessarily want to run it into a bunch of like, oh, I got to get these done before the Oscars.
Right.
I got to get these done before my friends fill out their awards ballots. All right. Well, this movie is currently in limited release as we have this conversation, but it is rolling out in more theaters this Friday. That'll be the Friday that the podcast is coming out. And then even more theaters on, I believe, November 1st. So eventually you're going to have an opportunity to see it in most places, I think. So 12 Years a Slave. Come and find us on Facebook after you've seen it at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. And tell us what you thought. We're interested in your reflections. Okay, speaking of reflections, we're going to make a little bit of a turn of tone. Is everyone ready?
So ready. Very excited.
We were going to talk today about rites of passage. This was another one of the topic suggestions that we got from all of you when we put out the call on Facebook. So we're going to talk about a rite of passage that we think might help the adolescent, the teenager, move into adulthood. Glenn Weldon, I'm going to start with you.
Okay. Jean-Paul Sartre said, hell...
Oh, God.
Hold on. Hold, hear me out. Hell is other people.
Yes.
Right? High school is other people plus pep rallies plus acne. Okay, so it is demonstrably worse, like measurably, objectively worse.
Right.
And the thing you want to tell teens is that high school ends. So anything you can do to kind of fortify their mental shell, their emotional shell, to help them power through is important, which is why a couple things we've talked about in the show before factor in here. The film Heathers has an outlook on the high school experience, which I think will fortify that shell nicely. The Buffy episode Earshot contains the sentiment, every single one of them, the other high school students, is ignoring your pain because they're too busy with their own.
Yeah, that's so very true.
As a bulwark against the kind of hobbling self-consciousness that kind of manifests in adolescence, I think that's important. I think that should replace the Pledge of Allegiance in American high schools. It should be hung above doors. It should be tattooed on foreheads. It's important. The thing, though, that I want every teenager to see, and this is going to be, you know, Glenn's tough talk for teens. I'm just going to, I'm sitting backwards in my
tough
chair.
Right,
right. I'm rolling up my sleeves. I would put them in a Ludovico Technique chair, like from Clockwork Orange, and make them watch this film.
It's 1980. Welcome to Rock and Roll High School.
Rock and Roll High School?
Do you want to stand there with my hand? Tell me, baby, if you're the man. Baby, do you want to stand? Do you want to stand under the moonlight?
That is, of course, the 1979 film Rock and Roll High School.
I could tell.
Which features lots of Ramones songs. You know what holds up about this film? The Ramones. They're in they're in rare form. Mm-hmm. Literally rare because Didi Ramone can barely speak. Didi Ramone is so wasted that either he's given one line, hey, pizza, and he kind of muffs it, can't quite power through it. That's the one thing in this film that works. Every damn thing else doesn't. This film was pitched squarely at the, hey, we're young teens and we're wild and free and rock and roll, man, and you can't keep us down with your rules, high school. And so it's filled with all these teachers getting all blustery and flustered when when rock and roll music comes over the PA system and the kids just got to get up and dance. So they chase the kids around shouting, demerit, demerit. Like, that's that kind of thing.
You have managed to upset the entire school with this godforsaken noise.
Things sure have changed since we got kicked out of high school.
Hey, come on, you guys, follow me into the school.
They tried to stop their music, but the kids got wrecked and rocked the school.
This film, if you show a kid this, a teenage kid this, what it will reinforce to them is that your precious iconoclastic impulses, your rebelliousness, will be rendered by time safe, innocuous, adorable. Right?
Wow.
I mean, that's...
That's dark,
that's a good, man.
That is very dark.
I think it's an important point. I mean, it's like, you know...
It's an important point.
You know the phrase, memento mori, remember you're going to die. I was going to do something like that, but that's what horror films do. Horror films are ways for kids to kind of, you know, have some sense of their own mortality. So this is some sense of your own fecklessness, your own imminent fecklessness.
How uncool you'll be
someday. How uncool you'll be. This film is just... It's a... store-bought
That's
anarchy
amazing.
T-shirt of a film. You know, it's just fake. So what I'm trying to say is kids sometimes need to be told, you're dumb, you think dumb things, you say dumb things, and you look dumb, and this film will bring that along. This film is so dumb that it ends with the school actually blowing up, which you'd think would have all kinds of really weird, uncomfortable associations today. But no, it's just so dumb and safe. But of course, if Thompson were here, he would say that this whole rock and roll's cool, man, don't hold us down, is the driving impulse of rock and roll, right? I mean, it's not just this film. It's Pink Floyd's We Don't Need No Education, which you do because you just use a double negative. Clearly, clearly you need some education. It's the Beastie Boys' Fight for Your Right to Party. No, don't. That's dumb. Right, do you mean... underage drinking? Then call it underage drinking. Don't call it a party. So that's it.
Boy, old man Weldon is really...
This is not. I knew you were going to say that. This is not curmudgeonliness. This is just truth. I'm speaking truth to that which in no way resembles power. I can grant that. But that's my pick, Rock and Roll High School. Their own songs are really great.
That's amazing.
Wow.
That's amazing, buddy. Cat Chow.
Well... my own piece of truth now isn't quite a film. It's more something that will happen to you inevitably as you're growing up. And I think rite of passage is kind of when somebody, a celebrity who is about your age who you've grown up watching and seen throughout the years, just becomes something that's completely not what they were.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, Amanda Bynes, when she just had her show, The Amanda Show, on Nickelodeon.
Hey, it's Amanda! Yeah!
Holy cow, it's a cartoon.
She was adorable. And I remember watching her show when I was young, and there was something so innocent and funny about her. She was like only 12 years old at the time and doing these stand-up bits and that were just really wacky. And I remember thinking, wow, like Amanda Bynes, I wish I could be like her. And in recent months, years,
it makes so much not more so much. Makes sense now. You make so much more sense as a person now.
Yeah, Jean, I hate you. I mean, yeah, I wanted to be a weird kid like Amanda Bynes.
And
but
you
now,
succeeded.
Yeah, to maybe.
but maybe not in the same way.
Maybe not in the same way. Now, I mean, if you go through her Twitter timeline, it's just completely fragmented. And there's not much else to say about how she is now besides that. But I remember, for example, also when Britney Spears got married twice and then shaved her head and just went through a whole bunch of things.
Yes.
It was really jarring to see these people who I saw on, you know, like Mickey Mouse Club or Nickelodeon just being more adult or dealing with adult issues in ways that I just didn't understand. And now it's more common. I mean, Miley Cyrus is perhaps going through that same type of morphing.
So the rite of passage is sort of someone that you associated your sort of your youth with their youth.
Yeah.
Suddenly,
where you identify.
You're a little bit disoriented by their approach to their adulthood.
Yes, exactly that.
Yeah. I can buy that. I will say I'm happy that you did not turn out exactly like Amanda Bynes.
not in a lot of ways.
I think that's probably a net positive.
I don't think I'd be working for NPR.
No.
But that's how she announces herself every morning. Hey, everyone, I'm Kay.
and this is my show. All right. Jean Demby, rite of passage.
So we were talking about this a little bit before the show, and mine is the slightly darker cousin of hers, which is that moment when you're growing up, when someone who is not much older than you, and maybe they're not even like your favorite artist or whatever, or favorite actor, when they have a tragic death that is way too premature. I imagine if you were like born in the 40s, that was probably like Janis Joplin for you. Or I remember when Tupac Shakur died and Biggie Smalls got shot. And I remember like thinking when I was 15 or whatever that those people were so old. I mean, not old, but they was like, oh, he's 24.
Sure.
And then I turned 24 and I was like, oh my gosh, these were children, essentially, right? I remember my mom waking me up the day that Biggie he was killed in L.A. And my mom was like, oh, Biggie Smalls died. And, you know, it's your mom. So you're like, oh, she, I don't know who died, but it wasn't Biggie Smalls. Maybe it was Heavy D. Maybe it was, it would have been tragic. But I'm like, not Biggie Smalls. Yeah. He's the biggest rapper in the world. And this is ridiculous. And then I remember there being like a pall over school that Monday when we went back to class. It was weird because it was one of those things that like, wow, like it felt so monumental to all of us.
Kurt Cobain is a big one
for a lot
of people. For maybe people a little bit younger than me, but I think that's a big one for a lot of people.
Right.
I don't know. I'm trying to think if I can think of one for that was quite that way for me, and nothing immediately comes. I mean, there were certain actors like River Phoenix was a big one. I don't think quite the same bond that you have with musicians. I think there's something about musicians that's different. Certainly for a lot of people, Michael Jackson, but that was...
Yeah. But he was already like...
I was going to say, that's kind of a different... That's kind of a whole different thing. He had kind of been through so many cycles and waves of life. And
speaking of people who age weirdly, as Kat just pointed out, that I mean, Kat doesn't... We were talking about this before, but Kat never remembers Michael Jackson in the pre...
I don't remember him in his glory days.
Yeah, like when he was just the guy whose videos were simulcast on Primetime.
Yeah. right.
She remembers him fully in like
when
eccentric.
He was, very eccentric. Just known for things that I don't think people expected.
I was middle school into high school around the time of Thriller. And at that time, he was another person that, you know, a couple of my friends had, like, you know, musician crushes on. It was just like, he was not particularly eccentric at all. And then we went through kind of the early odd stuff where it was like he had the chimp and stuff like that. And the things that were like odd, but not really upsetting. They were just kind of unusual. And you got the impression
they
were
quirky.
Quirky. But then it kind of got, it's definitely true that probably by the time Kat was paying attention, it was a little darker story.
There was something more sinister.
But yeah, it was. I remember distinctly where I was when my mom waking me up on a Sunday morning, like Biggie Smalls died. I'm like,
I don't know who died. No. I like the idea. They're just assuming it was someone else.
Right. And then his album comes out and it was like blaring from like every car in Philadelphia. Like, mm-hmm. It was just, I remember being like, oh my gosh, this is, I didn't think anything. Like, oh, hip hop will die. And I mean, it was so... It was so dramatic because we're teenagers or whatever. Mm.
Okay, so when I looked at Rites of Passage, I thought about, I went more Glenn's direction and thought about a kind of specific piece of culture. And what occurred to me was one that I would love to kind of rescue from commercial failure, because I think it makes a wonderful thing to show to kids, especially but not exclusively girls, which is the Drew Barrymore-directed roller derby movie Whip It, which I love.
Yep.
Which has...
Oh, yeah.
Ellen Page.
Really?
This was sort of an Ellen Page post-Juno.
Yeah, when she was still writing that
project. Kristen Wiig is in it. Drew Barrymore is in it. Marcia Gay Harden is in it. And Ellen Page plays a young woman who has a troubled relationship with her mother and kind of doesn't really feel at home in her environment particularly, and goes out and discovers roller derby. And this movie came out kind of at the time that roller derby had like its first big push a few years ago, and all of a sudden there's a lot of pop culture stuff about roller derby. And the thing I like about it is it's a coming of age story for a teenage girl who ultimately finds romance very disappointing, and ultimately finds that when you are like a 17-year-old girl, there is a lot of possibility that you are going to find boys very disappointing.
Like, yes.
They, at the very least, not the key to your great coming-of-age story, mm-hmm. which is typically how it's presented in movies, right? They, at the very least, they meet a boy in addition to whatever, like, don't tell mom the babysitter's dead or whatever, like... Yeah. In addition to everything else, you've got Josh Charles riding the hot dog truck. Like, by the way, you should also see Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. But what I love about it is that it is a coming-of-age story that revolves around, A, a community of women, and B, something you're good at. Like, something that will not necessarily make you famous, but that you just find skill in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she finds her self-knowledge from getting to know a bunch of people and making friends with them, and following a kind of path based on ability. And I think it's a terrific movie. Nobody saw it in theaters.
Right.
But I continue to believe that it is possible that it will be something that a certain number of people continue to love and watch, because it's lovely.
Yeah, I didn't like it as much as you did, but I certainly felt like Drew Barrymore is going to make another film. That's going to be great. Like,
yeah.
She has a sensibility. It's a great, she's a great storyteller. Yeah, that surprised me. Almost as much as surprised Gene, who was looking at you incredulously throughout your little speech.
I sometimes ignore the incredulousness with which Gene looks at me in certain situations.
Now, you haven't seen it, right, Gene?
I've not seen it.
Okay.
So I will take this.
It's really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was...
You don't have to see it. Yeah, I mean, not you were telling you. You
like, rattling off the cast. I'm like, that happened? How did I not know?
It was a surprising but good cast. I mean, so many names in there. Yeah.
Oh, and Alia Shawkat is in that movie from Arrested Development.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Cousin Maybe. Eve is in that movie, I think.
Eve, really?
I think it's Eve.
Wow.
Who's in that movie. Anyway, I don't know. I love it. Whip It. I will tell you, after Thompson saw it, he said he was going to give it to his daughter as soon as he felt like she was old enough to appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. And as cheesy as it is, I remember what I liked a lot about that film was that I liked how she found friends in, you know, unexpected places.
Of course. There's nothing wrong with that. Like, well, this is kind of like one of the reviews that I was reading about this movie today when I was kind of rediscovering it and trying to remember whether other people had liked it as much as I did. Is there a couple of reviews that basically said, look, it's expected. It's kind of cliches, but so are lots of really good movies, mm-hmm. like, especially for kids. Like, you got to remember, you know, your average 13-year-old hasn't seen 4,000 sports movies like the way you have when you're tragically 40. So those are our Rites of Passage, and you should come and find us on Facebook or on the blog. Tell us about your Rites of Passage. Tell us what we missed, and tell us how good Whip It is. Tell Gene how good Whip It is, because it's so good. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week. Glenn Weldon, I'm going to start with you. What on earth is making you happy this week?
Well, I went on a snorkeling vacation last week. And by the way, great show last week. I mean, you know, and I'm very sincerely appreciative that you saved the segment on we sit around telling each other about our feelings for a week that I was away. Hugely popular. People loved that, that episode. On the Facebook page is just awash in tears. Yeah. People volunteering there.
What would you have said?
Emotions. I don't. I mean, all I know is that I am going to be on vacation again in November. So maybe that's the one where you bust out the "What's making us grumpy" segment. What makes us feel jejune? I don't know. Snorkeling is one of the things making me happy because, you know, I thought all my life I wanted to be a marine biologist. I went to school for marine biology. I got a degree in marine biology.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah, and it turns out that I never wanted to be a marine biologist. It turns out what I wanted to be was a tourist. I found that out because that's it was
I thought
all
you were going to say what you wanted to be was Aquaman.
No, well, that there is that. But I mean, like that experience was all of marine biology minus organic chemistry, calculus 2, all the horrible soul-crushing parts of it. But the thing that is making me happy this week is a new collection of Blu-ray DVDs starring Vincent Price called the Vincent Price Collection. Time of year for exactly this. I don't go in for spooky or gory. I go in for old-time cheesy horror. And the films that are in this four-disc collection are six of them. There's The Fall of the House of Usher, The Haunted Palace, Mask of the Red Death, my favorite, The Pit and the Pendulum, The Abominable Dr. Fibes, and The Witchfinder General. Now, those first five share a certain sensibility. They're overripe, let's say. There's an overripe quality to them. The colors are really super saturated. The Mask of the Red Death is going to look great on Blu-ray because those colors are just going to pop. And it's Vincent Price chewing the scenery and kind of rubbing his hands with evil glee as he is his wont.
But it doesn't have the Brady Bunch two-parter where they find the tiki.
Does not, nor does he play Egghead. But the last one, and that's is The Witchfinder General, is a weird choice to put in there because it has a totally different sense about it. It's a much darker film, a much grimmer film, and he's evil, but he's not evil, you know, there's a difference. But you should still pick up the Vincent Price Collection from Shout Factory.
Wonderful. Kat Chow, what is making you happy this week?
Well, this week, on Thursday actually, to be very specific, it's my birthday! Uh-huh. So yay! I'm turning 15. I'm just kidding. So in a year I'll be able to drive a car.
No.
Okay.
You're going to get carded for like the next 40 years. Yes,
I know. Exactly. The other day actually, last week I forgot my badge and I handed the security person my driver's license and then they handed me back a temporary badge and it said, intern forgot security badge. I was like, okay, well, this is happening.
Yeah, I will tell you a quick story. I was buying booze a couple weeks ago and the guy says, do you have some ID? And I'm in the middle of being like, you know, I'm pretty cool. Like, I'm getting carded. Like, this is great, right? And I hand him my ID and he looks at it and he goes, whoa. And I was like, I don't know how to take that. On the one hand, you know, you look much younger than you are. On the other hand, you're much older than you look. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, so that's one thing. Uh-huh. But actually, what's also making me happy is today, Code Switch did our very first Ask Me Anything on Reddit.
That was so great. I read that.
Thank you. So what happened, Gene, the person who I hate the most, he actually did a really wonderful story with our other reporter, Shireen Marisol Meraji, on the whitest historically black college called Bluefield State in West Virginia.
That story is so good.
Yeah, you guys should go check it out. If you haven't read it already, listen to Shireen's story too. And then go look at the Reddit Ask Me Anything. Reddit's just this interesting space to talk about race on the internet because it's done in such a weird sort of men's rights way that we always kind of have to like stave off like, oh yeah, this is why we should talk about race. So it's been my dream since coming to Code Switch to kind of slowly infiltrate.
You were very excited about
the Reddit thing. Yeah, I kept turning to Gene and saying, aren't you so excited? Isn't this so much fun? And he just ignored me.
It was cool though. Yeah. It looked like great fun.
Yeah, so that's what's making me happy.
Thank you, Kat Chow. Gene Demby, person that Kat Chow hates the most. What is making you happy this week other than that?
What's making me happy is that Kat is 1 year closer to death. So the first thing that's making me happy is Janelle Monáe. Her new album came out last month. It's her second proper album. And last week I saw her in concert. And,
yes, you did.
If you have not seen her in concert, you should do that. It is ridiculous. I mean, it wasn't like a big venue by any means, but she has this like musical theater hammy kind of like, we're gonna put on a review, guys. Yeah. Like, it's very like when I was a kid I wanted to be Prince, and so she decided to be like what she imagined a Prince concert would be like, you know. And she like grounds it all in this weird Afrofuturism where it's like, oh, in the future, you know, the droids will be, I mean, droids are analog for black people in her world, but it's all this crazy sci-fi jargon, and she just like really fun to watch. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is, so I don't know if you ever seen these like web only videos that the Roots have been doing with Jimmy Fallon. Mm-hmm. They're just The Roots playing some pop stars' music with elementary school instruments, like kazoos and triangles and xylophones. And I know Miley Cyrus, like, stands athwart human progress or whatever. But they recently did, like, an acapella-ish version of We Can't Stop with her. And it has, like, the Brady Bunch squares.
It's so good.
And it's so good. And it shouldn't be good because Miley Cyrus. But it was really, really fun.
It's our party. We can say what we want. It's our party. We can love who we want. We can kiss who we want. We can sing what we want.
Yeah, cause there's sweaty bodies everywhere. Hands in the air like we don't care. Cause we came to have so much fun now. That somebody here might get some now.
Y'all are out there thinking that Gene's just trying to impress me with this pick. Those of you who know me. But I did not coach this pick at all. He just said it because he's awesome.
Oh, thank you. That's very sweet of you.
Thank you, Gene.
You yourself are awesome.
Thank you, Gene Demme.
All right, that's enough.
All right, so
yeah, knock that off.
So here's the two things. I have two things also making me happy this week. I am, for reasons that baffle me a little bit, I was asked incredibly kindly by the Folger Library to moderate a discussion this week with Maria Semple and Tom Prada, who are both lovely and fine authors. And I was reading Maria Semple's book, Where'd You Go, Bernadette, which is a sort of epistolary novel-ish about this woman who disappears and her daughter is trying to find her. And it's this compendium. On the one hand, it's this very sad story, but it's also this incredibly funny compendium of, like, emails back and forth between, like, the woman who's making her miserable at the PTA, essentially,
yeah,
and her friend. And, you know, there are little shreds of this and bits of that and emails going back and forth and IMs. And it's such a lovely, lovely combination of a really moving story and something that's genuinely just so funny. I enjoyed it tremendously. I was so glad that I read it, especially since I'm doing this thing. It was, I thought, a good idea. So that's my one thing. My other thing is that of all the Sunday night television that has been kicking around, the one that for me is firing on all cylinders right now is The Good Wife. Of all things, the broadcast television show. They are doing a storyline right now involving, this is not particularly spoilery if you're anywhere close to caught up with the show. They're doing a storyline right now about a potential kind of division in the firm where some of the people are going to leave the firm and go off and start their own firm, which, as you know, if you know anything about big law firms, that's a gigantically controversial, difficult, you know, you have to try to take your clients and who's going to get the clients and who's going to get the billings. And they have written the heck out of this story, and they are playing the heck out of this story, and it's so good. And if you really want to watch some of it, I will personally help anyone who wants to get caught up so that you can enjoy some of these fantastic episodes. The weekend that this podcast comes out, they are putting out an episode that I have seen in advance, and it's so good. It is so crazy. So while everybody's out talking about The Walking Dead and Breaking Bad and premium cable and everything, broadcast television, free with commercials,
yes.
The Good Wife, CBS, Sunday nights, very, very excellent. So that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow Kat Chow at Kat Chow. That's K-A-T-C-H-O-W. You can follow Gene at G-D-2-15. That's G-E-E-D-E-E-2-1-5. You can follow our absent pal, Stephen Thompson, at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. And our absent pal, Trey Graham, at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow our producer, Lauren McGaki, at L McGaki, M-I-G-A-K-I. And you can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Kat and Gene, it is always a special treat to enjoy your presence and company.
Thank you for having us.
We thank all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.